Hi, I'm John Follett, editor of Designing for Emerging Technologies. With me today is Matt Nishlapidus, partner and design director at Normative, and one of the book's contributing authors. Matt's essay explores design for the networked world, a practice for the 21st century, which we're going to explore a little bit in this interview today. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
So in your chapter, you discuss pre-industrial, industrial, and post-industrial objects. Could you give us a quick overview and maybe some examples of each of those types?
Yeah, absolutely. So the main example that I have been thinking about is glasses. I find glasses to be a really fascinating piece of technology that has existed for longer than most of the things that we still use today. And if you look at a pair of glasses from the pre-industrial era, so this is anything from, you know, medieval up through the kind of 17, 1800s, what you're seeing is an object that's the direct expression of a single craftsperson and was made for a single individual to use. So it's a representation of that craftsperson's view of what glasses should be. And they create one and they sell that one pair. And it's often, at the time anyway, also made on commission. So it was rare that they would make large quantities of the same thing and have them sitting around. So pre-industrial in this way is an expression of the individual craftsperson involved. Industrial moved us to a mode where you had a designer, or a craftsperson in this case being the designer, creating a model of what glasses should be and then having that model mass-produced. And the new methods of production and new materials that were available allowed the designer to create something that they'd never been able to create before on a mass scale. And you also had, on the consumer side, the emergence of many people buying and owning and using basically the exact same object. So in the industrial model, the object itself, in this case the glasses, becomes an expression of that scale. It's no longer a direct expression of the individual craftsperson communicating with an individual customer. Instead, it's kind of a one-to-many relationship between the designer and the people who end up using this product. Once we move into this post-industrial era, which we're kind of entering now, the relationship's starting to shift again, and glasses are a really interesting example. And so we go from having a single pair of glasses made for a single person, handmade usually, to a pair of glasses designed and then mass manufactured for a countless number of people, to having a pair of glasses that expresses a lot of different things. And so on one hand, you have something like Google Glass, which is still mass produced, but the glasses actually contain embedded functionality. But then we also have, with the emergence of 3D printing and small scale manufacturing, a return to a little bit of that artisan kind of one-to-one relationship where you could get something that someone's made just for you. And so these post-industrial objects are more of an expression of the networked world in which we now live. We have a way of building relationships with individual craftspeople. We also have objects that exist in the network themselves as a physical instantiation of the networked environment that we live in. And so we go from pre-industrial, where we have an expression of a craftsperson, to industrial, which is kind of a mass expression, to post-industrial, which is the individual craftsperson now making one thing that is used by many people, but it's the one thing. It's not copies of that one thing.
Right. Please go ahead.
I was just going to say, we go from a one craftsperson, one customer, to a one craftsperson, many customers, to a one craftsperson, one product that many people can use.
Right. So given the way, other aspects of sort of personalization can be now built into these post-industrial products, how does that affect post-industrial product design? What are the characteristics, sort of the new characteristics that the post-industrial product designer needs to incorporate into his or her practice?
So there's a lot of new kinds of complexity that you have to think about when producing something, even if that thing is just a physical object with no inherent functionality or technology built into it. Means of production have changed quite a bit. So the options are much more vast than they used to be, but the scales are very different. So you have the ability to kind of micro-produce things, but also to produce single one-off things. So the designer in this case has to go back to thinking about the individuals or small subsets of people that the product serves. And then when we get into embedded technology and objects that actually are part of the network infrastructure, it's not just about the physical object anymore. The object becomes a container for software. And that software can do things that are invisible and that affect all sorts of other aspects of the environment. And that person's relationship with the objects and with the other people that object puts them in touch with.
So in your chapter for designing for emerging technologies, you highlight a set of aesthetic qualities of a network system, which I found to be fascinating, because you're proposing these foundational elements for designing objects within a network, and then the aesthetic understanding of the network itself. Let's talk a little bit about each of these foundational elements that you propose, starting with texture. Now, what do you mean by the texture of a system?
Sure. So this whole idea comes from a tradition of design foundations, which has been established for quite a while and is much more commonplace in industrial design and graphic design and architecture, where there are physical properties of objects that you have to understand in order to be able to make something with them. So when we get into designing software and networked things, where the physical limitations are a little different and the material properties become much more abstract, we haven't yet done a really great job of thinking about the aesthetics of those types of material properties, those invisible properties. And what's interesting about invisible properties is that they quickly become visible when you're trying to interact with the system at hand. So taking texture as the first one, for example, texture is looking at the way the system connects to all of the other pieces that exist within it, or how those pieces interact with each other. So when you have a system that has multiple nodes, and those nodes could be human or inhuman or physical objects or pieces of software, how does the communication between those happen? And is it smooth? Is it easy? Is that a difficult connection? Is there a lot of interference? So when you start to talk about that in terms of a texture of connection, you can look at how obvious the connections are. If they're really obvious and easy and you can access them and you understand what you're supposed to put in them or what you're going to get out of them, you could talk about that as a smooth form of communication. If it's really confusing or you get something unexpected, or there's interference from other aspects of the system, you could start talking about that as rough or as other types of descriptors. And this gives us a kind of a fuzzy aesthetic language to start talking about how it feels to be inside of a complex system. And you could think about things like this for interfaces, both graphical and gestural, spatial interfaces, hardware controls, or even machine-to-machine communications. So how do you describe your interactions with a large system like your telephone provider, your cell phone provider? Is your relationship with that system smooth or rough? And I'm sure a lot of people will probably say rough for that one for many reasons.
Yeah, that would include me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a fine example. And I like the way the language of aesthetics is applied to these so-called invisible interactions. I think that's an extremely valuable way for designers to start thinking about that. In fact, I'm sure there are times when you might actually deliberately create a rough interaction, mm-hmm. if it's, for example, if you're creating simulations, for instance, where you want to create a rough network so you can simulate maybe some third world or developing world connectivity.
The nice thing about the way we're trying to develop this language is that it's non-judgmental. So texture is not a quality that's good or bad. It just is what it is. And within the context of the larger system or understanding what you're trying to achieve within it, you can start to make judgment calls about what type of texture you would like to have your in your system or you'd like your interactions to embody. And so that way it's not about judging the kind of overall quality of something. Instead, it's about creating a language that we can use to talk about the different aspects of that thing that you can't actually see or touch.
The next element you talk about is agency. Could you describe that a little bit?
Sure. So what I mean by agency is the ability for one part of the system to act on other parts of the system and impose kind of its will, if you will. So when you look at your system and all the different pieces in it, which pieces have the ability to make decisions and do they have the ability to impose those decisions on other pieces? So can a person interfacing with the system do things? Do they have ways of interacting with the system that will affect the rest of it? Are they passive consumers? Are there other aspects of the system that can exert their influence on the rest of it? So for example, a lot of the systems that we're comfortable with or that we use every day are very human-centered in terms of their agency. We have a lot of control over what happens. So, driving a car or using your computer are things that you are the main input of control. You tell it what to do and it does that thing, hopefully. There are other types of systems, largely invisible, where we have less agency. So algorithmic stock trading is a good example, where the algorithm actually exerts its influence and control over the rest of the system, and the people involved have very little influence on it once it's running. Another example, which I use in the chapter, is the traffic light sensors that are hidden under the pavement in a lot of big cities, where as the person who's in the middle of this system, I don't have the ability to actually exert my control on it. Instead, the system makes decisions on its own and they control me via the traffic lights.
Yeah, those systems with low agency I find frustrating, especially the ones with the triggering the lights, because inevitably you get some part of that doesn't work exactly right and you end up sitting at the light either far longer than you meant to.
Yeah, absolutely. And part of that isn't necessarily about low agency, but having the right agency. So when designing these types of things, it's important to think about all the different nodes in your network. So what are the pieces of the system that have control that they can exert on other pieces? And where do you favor different types of control? So there might be things that humans really need to control or are really good at controlling. And there might be things that machines are really good at controlling. And creating that right balance is a really important part of making a system that feels good to the people who are using it.
So tell us a little bit about opacity, which is the next quality you describe.
So opacity kind of builds on the other ones, and it's really about how obvious are the inputs to the system for people who are interfacing with it, or for non-people who are interfacing with it, for machines. So when you encounter some sort of system, do you know what you can do with it? Does it wear its interfaces on its sleeve, so to speak, or is everything very hidden? Do I kind of have to feel around or guess? Maybe I don't even know it's there, or don't even know it's happening. And from a computer perspective, with APIs and other machine-to-machine interfaces, are they discoverable? Can I tell, or can one system tell what the other one is going to allow it to do? Or is that stuff all hidden away? Do I have no way of figuring out what my inputs are? And so the traffic light example, again, is an interesting one because in some places, The systems are completely opaque, where you don't even know they exist, and therefore you have no way of influencing the outcomes or exerting your agency. And there are some places where they make it really obvious that these systems exist and what you're supposed to do in order to interface with them, like push buttons on stoplights, or visible pads on the surface of the road so that you know where you're supposed to go in order to make a change in the system.
Lastly, you refer to reflexivity as a quality of a system. Mm-hmm. How does reflexivity manifest?
So it manifests in a number of ways. One is in feedback. How do all the pieces of a system know what state it's in and what the other pieces are doing? Is it good at communicating? If one piece changes something or exerts its agency over another piece, does that change the state of the system in a way that's visible to all of the components, including the people? And how does it communicate those changes back to the other pieces? So again, this isn't necessarily a quality related thing as much as it is a way of using some language to describe the feeling of a system. So, does it do a good job of telling you what state it's in? And if it does, is that important or not important? And if it doesn't, maybe that's a good thing because you shouldn't have to know about it. And then how does it provide that feedback? Does it have flashing lights? Does it send messages? Does it send too many messages? and when the state changes, how does it inform all those other pieces? And these four things, so the texture, agency, opacity, and reflexivity all work together. So none of them exist in isolation of the other ones. And when one of them isn't quite right, or one of them is doing something that's less desirable in the network or in the system, it often is manifest through problems with the other ones. So you might have an opacity problem that manifests as a rough texture, for instance, because the people trying to act in the system don't understand where they can act. So you end up with something that feels really rough and loosely held together and complicated just because it's not clear enough to everybody what they're able to do.
Right. I think these, this type of language around system aesthetics, I think, is going to be extremely important for designers as more and more we're expected to create, you know, products that exist within a larger ecosystem and sort of figure out how to, you know, properly, you know, create the right experience for people. Mm-hmm. So I found this part of your chapter to be really fascinating from a designer's perspective.
That's great. Thank you. And I agree. I mean, there's very little that we work on these days that's not informed by or part of some sort of software system. Anything from a company's corporate website to the products that they sell to this way they provide their service, the call centers that do customer support, government services, financial services, all of it is software driven now, which means that all of it has aspects of these aesthetic properties. And we think far too little about the way that it feels to engage with these types of systems and services, rather than just how well they work or how efficient they are. But how does it actually feel to be part of this? And how can we start describing that in a way that helps us design them better?
Matt, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.